Tonight, I want to offer some words about ancestors. This is a topic that's near and dear to me for a number of reasons, and those will become apparent as I speak. But I have been thinking a lot about ancestors in the context of current events as well. So I wanted to share some thoughts about ancestors with you. And before I begin the talk itself, I wanted to say something about my use in this talk of the words we and our. So I am speaking as a practice leader. I am a white person. I am past middle age now. I use the pronouns she and her. I am the daughter of Italian immigrants, and those are my personal ancestors. So I'm sitting here with before you, with you, with all of that sitting with and in me. And I wanted to acknowledge at the start that what I am going to say is conditioned by these factors and other factors. And not everyone may resonate with everything I say, may not feel included in everything I say because of that. But what I am trying to express by we and our is the current shared moment in this country that we are living in, so differently experienced and impacting us very disparately, and also our shared practice from the perspective of our shared practice, which I will return to several times in the talk. So by we, I mean those residing here in the United States, and we also and especially means we honored followers of the Buddha, the Sangha, you all and me and the community of practice and of suffering and of liberation from suffering. So that is a preliminary. In these days in this country, and not only in this country, we are reckoning with our national history and the history that we carry before we became a nation state. The history that began with the arrivals of Europeans in the Americas. This reckoning has us in conflict over who we are and what our responsibility for our history is. You know, Black people especially are asking, they are demanding that we recognize, all of us, and accept responsibility for what their enslaved ancestors suffered and contributed to making the United States of America a place where others could come and try their chance at the so-called American dream. People are still coming from all over, or trying to, for the dream of prosperity, of security, of opportunity, where the next generation is better off than the present one. That still draws immigrants, even in this moment. And it drew my family about a century ago now. It is often said we are a nation of immigrants. And many of us in the United States are newcomers or descended from immigrants, whether their forebears arrived hundreds of years ago or today. But what made the country a place where newcomers could arrive and start a new life is the enslavement for centuries of Black people, starting before the country was founded. We also know that the immigrants who were most welcomed in this country were white, and the vision of the founders was a full citizenship for white men. Quotas and exclusions curtailed or stopped immigrants from Asia and Southern Europe for over half a century in attempts to preserve and enhance the proportion of the population that was white. Before all of this, before the first slave ship arrived in Virginia in the early 17th century, indigenous territories, cultures, and lives were forfeited. The histories of brown people, of Asian people, are of suffering, exclusion, hatred, resentment, suspicion, all of which have long histories. And to keep this from becoming a history lecture, I'm not going to continue in this vein, but I could, of course, for the rest of the evening. So what I just said is an incomplete account of the past in just this nation. And part of this moment is a struggle not only over the history of this country, over justice, privilege, and rights, but over ancestors. The ancestors who were set up at different points in a new quasi-mythic civic genealogy. And we see the conflict over these ancestors, I think, most prominently right now in the practice of setting up Confederate monuments generations after the end of the Civil War, monuments meant to reaffirm the position of white people in this country, in the South especially, but not only. Then there are the founders, who are supposed to be our national ancestors, but are now, and recently, not just now, being held to account for their slaveholding. And in the case of some, like Jefferson, multiple sexual assaults. Statues of Columbus, who was the catalyst for enslavement, disease, death of indigenous people in the Americas, are coming down. And there are others in this list. Father Serra in California, and the conquistador Juan Oñate in New Mexico, to name just two. We are examining the full legacy of recent American icons such as John Muir and Margaret Sanger. This reckoning, even when driven at times by a desire to protect corporate or institutional interests, goes far. Here I want to pause and go back to Columbus. Christopher Columbus, 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. That's what I was taught. The story of how he got a holiday is a convoluted one, but the main point I want to make is that getting Columbus inscribed in the national consciousness as a kind of proto-founder with a national holiday was a way to make Southern Italians, especially Southern Italians, who were legally white but regarded as not fully acceptable in the American South especially, to gain acceptance in America. The objective was to create an Italian-American ancestor. Columbus was in competition with the Norse Leif Erikson, who sailed to Canada 500 years before Columbus arrived in the Caribbean for a national holiday. And actually, Erikson has a holiday in some parts of the country. And it is a sign of these times that Columbus has joined the ranks of rejected ancestors. But his original insertion into the list of founders was an attempt by one group of immigrants who were discriminated against and who sometimes suffered violence to claim a place through presenting an acceptable national ancestor, at least for a time. And this is an example of yearning to have a place in the national lineage. And the resistance to losing a place in the lineage runs deep because it challenges the stories of who we are and our worthiness, as well as our suffering. And this is human, whatever else it is. Now, I don't need to tell a Zen Sangha, especially this one, about the prominence of ancestors in Buddhist practice, right? The lineage represents a chain of transmission through time and space, starting with the seven Buddhas before Buddha and ending either with Dogen, and his immediate successors, or the founder of whatever temple where the chanting is happening. And the lineage, of course, represents continuity, and it represents authenticity. In only the last couple of decades have we confronted the absence of women in the list of Buddhas and ancestors that is chanted in so many Soto Zen temples. The first change in some lineages was from calling the lineage the patriarchs, and to start calling them ancestors. But then due to the efforts of many women and men, we now have a list of women teachers that mirrors the structure of the other list, Indian ancestors first, then Chinese, then Japanese. None of these women ancestors inherited the Dharma from each other in the way that Zen considers authentic. They could not do that as they were not abbots of temples until the very last woman on the list, Acharya Chiono, or Mugai Nyodai. She formally inherited the Dharma from her Chinese Rinzai teacher in Japan and founded a training temple for women. It no longer exists, but at the time it was ranked the highest of five such Rinzai temples for women. It is interesting to note that our women's lineage ends with her. Her lifetime overlaps with that of Dogen and his immediate successors, but also what occurs with Chieno is the formal entrustment and empowerment of a Zen woman as a full teacher and abbess. Earlier women, even though several were recognized by their male teachers, did not inherit their temples, their teachers' temples, or their teaching authority. So as you all know, the women ancestors are chanted now in many Soto temples in the U.S., and some teachers are now providing two lineage documents when they offer the precepts to their students. Despite the objections from some quarters that it's not a real lineage because the women's lineage does not record actual institutional passing of authority, we can recognize that the male lineage also has its gaps and its myths and focus on what is important, the power of ancestors and claims to belong among the ancestors, and also, of course, realization of women, the ability of women to realize the Dharma and to teach. We should recognize that the women's lineage is a kind of restitution or reparations. And these women are not the ancestors only of women practitioners. They recognize and restore women to the inheritance of Zen, of the teaching and passing on of the teaching, body to body and mind to mind. Right? So this is a crucial and ongoing development in Buddhism. These various examples, and we can all think of many, many more, lead to a general question. And before asking it, I want to say again that I'm using the terms our and we here with some caution and advisedly. I'm speaking to a Sangha in the United States at a time when all the ancestors are being scrutinized, right? And various ones are being invoked. The question is, what and who are ancestors now? What do we do with our past and the ancestors that we have been given, national, ethnic, racial, spiritual as well, now that we are looking closely, challenging prevailing narratives? And what about cultural appropriation? In our lineage, our Zen lineage, we were entrusted with the teachings in the forms and the forms by our Asian teachers, and I feel this entrustment was a gift. And even though I don't know the languages and I practice in this body, not an Asian one, I feel affinity and I feel okay with wearing these robes and practicing the way we practice. At the same time, I feel compassion for Italian forebears who wanted to be accepted and who worked to insert a man who, with other Europeans, brought about unimaginable suffering and destruction to the native peoples of the Americas. That compassion does not cancel out what Columbus and other quote-unquote explorers did. I have to hold both. I feel compassion and resonance with everyone doing genealogical research, you know, creating the list of women ancestors, a kind of genealogical research, searching for our lineages to understand our place in the world. And for those whose ancestors left no written trace, we are tracing them in our very DNA. And even for those who embrace imagined ancestral communities, whose exclusivity and claims to supremacy are used sometimes to denigrate and oppress others, all of these instances point to the power of ancestors and the idea of lineage, and we can understand this human impulse, but how to hold it all. So here I want to turn to the recent experience of the scholar of Buddhism and Soto Zen priest, Duncan Ryukan Williams. He was born in Japan. His mother is Japanese and his father is British. And on Juneteenth of this year, he took the oath of citizenship. In the midst of COVID and therefore with no guests to observe and share the event, wearing his formal priest robes, but masked and distanced from others who were there for the same purpose, to take the oath. And he wrote an account of his experience on Facebook, and he said, and I quote, "An invisible thread of connection, as immigrants to this country, waiting for our chance to walk into a new sense of possibility and belonging, was all too apparent even behind those face-obscuring masks. We had not planned this crossing of paths at this particular place, at this particular moment. Yet here we were, in relationship with one another. What struck me most at that moment, says Duncan, was how this line towards citizenship illustrates a central truth of Buddhism, interconnectedness. We might not choose every aspect of how or why we are connected, but that doesn't lessen the linkage, which extends backwards and forwards in time through people and generations and histories. Who we are right now is the karmic linkage between the past and the future. And he then went on to talk of the interdependent reality of Indra's net, at each knot a jewel reflecting all the others. And then he invoked the history behind Juneteenth, and he said some names: Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, David McAtee. So the son of a Japanese mother, he also invoked the Japanese in turn during the Second World War in the United States. And still, he became a citizen. He was inscribed in the lineage of this country. I found this account inspiring, and it resonated with my own family's immigrant experience. But I want to juxtapose it with a very different kind of experience, also a published piece of quite wrenching op-ed in the Washington Post, written in June, when Confederate monuments in places like Richmond, Virginia, and elsewhere were coming down. And this was written by Carolyn Randall Williams, who is currently a writer in residence at Vanderbilt University. She's also a poet. And she wrote, this was not the Washington Post, the New York Times, if you want to go look it up. If you haven't seen it, it's worth reading the whole thing. This is what she said in response to objections to the monuments coming down in the way they were coming down. She said, quote, "If they," meaning Southern whites, "if they want monuments, well then, my body is a monument. My skin is a monument." She said, "What is a monument but a standing memory? An artifact to make tangible the truth of the past. My body and blood are a tangible truth of the South and its past. The black people I come from were owned by the white people I come from. The white people I come from fought and died for their lost cause. I ask you now, who dares to tell me to celebrate them? Who dares to ask me to accept their mounted pedestals?" And she replies for herself, "You cannot dismiss me as someone who doesn't understand. You cannot say it wasn't my family members who fought and died. My blackness does not put me on the other side of anything. It puts me squarely at the heart of the debate. I don't just come from the South. I come from Confederates." And she concludes, "I am not an outsider who makes these demands. I am a great-great-granddaughter." So this is also the reckoning written in the body. And the black teacher Zenju Earthlin Manuel writes about how she spoke with her ancestors when grappling with the menial work she was assigned early in her Zen training. And she came to see the temple as a place where her ancestors had brought her to transform her suffering. And she says, "I began to see the ascendance from enslaved Africans as a sanctioned and gifted walk toward the very liberation the Buddha spoke of, and what the ancestors saw for me and everyone else, for everyone else." And in this, I hear an echo of what Duncan Williams says at the end of his account. Duncan said, "We think freedom is about independence, but actually freedom is about interdependence. As I celebrate my first Independence Day as a U.S. citizen, I join a lineage of American ancestors who have taught us that the project of emancipation in America cannot be accomplished alone, and that the journey to liberation extends across generations and communities. Even if we are masked and standing apart without friends or family in a line to become a citizen, we are simultaneously surrounded by all those who have come before us and those who will come after us. All of us inexorably tied together, and every single one of us implicated in the struggle to actualize freedom. So as a Zen priest, Duncan uses the Buddhist idea of a lineage as both linear and circular. We are simultaneously in a line, and we are surrounded also by ancestors. So here is the place where I would like to, in conclusion, invoke our high ancestor Dogen, Dogen Zenji, the founder of Soto Zen in Japan, to help understand how to hold it all. If they are all our ancestors, how do we hold all of this? And I'm thinking of the chant that we sometimes chant before lecture, the Ehe Koso Hotsugamon, which can be translated, the title can be translated, the High Ancestor Ehe Dogen's Aspiration Vow. And the first line is this: we vow with all beings from this life on throughout countless lives to hear the true Dharma, that upon hearing it, no doubt will arise in us, nor will we lack in faith that upon meeting it, we shall renounce worldly affairs and maintain the Buddha Dharma. And then in doing so, the great earth and all living beings together will attain the Buddha way. So this, of course, is our Bodhisattva vow. We do not attain the Buddha way by ourselves any more than we vow by ourselves. And the great earth and all living beings together attain the Buddha way. Dogen also says, revering Buddhas and ancestors, we are one Buddha and one ancestor. Awakening Bodhi mind, we are one Bodhi mind. And this sentence is a glimpse of non-duality. We are the ancestors. They are not in the past. They are not even somebody else. And not only are we not separate from each other, as we usually think, we are one ancestor. We are one Buddha. Dogen goes on to quote another Zen master, Lungya, who lived 400 years before he did. Lungya said, and this is Dogen's quote, those who in past lives were not enlightened will now be enlightened. In this life, save the body, which is the fruit of many lives. Before Buddhas were enlightened, they were the same as we. Enlightened people of today are exactly as those of old. So save the body, which is the fruit of many lives. This body, your body, my body. But it also raises a question for me. Who is it who was not enlightened in the past? When we wake up, everyone wakes up throughout space and time. So we have a big responsibility in confronting our ancestors, in accepting our ancestors. There is no separation between beings now or ever. This is Dogen's vision of emptiness as complete interbeing. And Dogen concludes here, this is actually, of course, an extract from a longer piece, the Mountains and Water Sutra, but as we have it as this text that we chant, Dogen concludes by calling on us to, to confess and repent before the ancestors. In this way, disclosing our lack of faith and practice, we will all realize together. They will help us to realize. We can't realize without them, and they don't realize without us. So the reckoning, the response to what is happening now, calls for confession and repentance. So can we, the followers of the Buddha, ask and require a reckoning, even fueled by great anger and deep pain, to arrive at a place of wholeness and compassion for ourselves and for everyone in the past and going forward? Can we deeply explore the causes and conditions as Dogen exhorts us, seeing all the suffering and all the ancestors who have brought all of us here now? What are the odds that any of us would find this path? Our practice calls us to see both the relative, that is the particular, including the ancestors we choose or are given by time and place, and the absolute. You know, and merging difference with unity should not be some kind of spiritual bypass. We would not be here without all of our ancestors, and we are all linked through all space and time. So I'd like to conclude with the words of Zenju, whom I quoted earlier. Only yesterday I found a comment that she posted on Facebook, the Oracle Facebook. She said, "One cannot be non-dual or non-separate. We can't make non-duality happen. It is not in our control, thank goodness. We experience non-duality through our dual lives, our everyday lives. We are embodied, and therefore our duality, the black and white of it, the experience of our bodies, our lives, are gateways to non-duality. When we know ourselves to be completely interrelated, like our global experience with COVID, our current suffering under military tactics, then we treat each other's lives more sacredly. The ancient spiritual teaching of no self means we do not exist without relationships to what's in the world. Our engagement with everything is crucial, especially today." Thank you very much.
Thank you, Choro. Would you take a few questions or comments?
I would welcome questions and comments. Help me with this topic. So if anyone has anything to offer, please.
Rachel.
So.
My commentary is that I really appreciate this talk that strikes to the heart of something I've been wondering about quite a bit lately. So thank you very much.
Hi, Rachel. Good to see you.
Nice to see you too. And Bunkai.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Margarita.
I think I will share only one reflection that came up as you were talking. And I had a lot of thoughts, partly because among the Dharma teachers, to whom I'm very grateful for transmission and for grooming me in many ways, you know, there were two, one of whom went embroiled into a huge scandal. And it took me several years to work out my relationship to him. I left the Sangha and I left him because I thought what he was doing, inappropriate sexual activity and a lot of other things, were totally inappropriate. I saw that before the scandal became public. But then I had to sort out my feelings towards him, and I've had other teachers or other individuals who I consider ancestors, both genetically or whom I never met, like, you know, Simone de Beauvoir, who was the first major intellectual who made me reflect on my identity as a woman. So to me, there is one general difference, and there are some of them with whom I have had a direct positive flow of some kind of transmission that has opened me up and made me wiser or more compassionate. And then there are others from whom I received a significant goodness, but whether because their behavior or at other times, misunderstandings of some kind or problems of some kind. My appreciation of them and my recognition of them is somewhat tainted. And these could be also, you know, the Cristoforo Colombo or the historical figures that we think of. To me, when people commit severe harm towards other, unless they seek some form of redemption or forgiveness, I may still recognize that they made a significant contribution. But I cannot really honor them as ancestors or as teachers. They have broken the covenant or the samaya, as they call it in Tibetan Buddhism. So these are just some thoughts that I thought I wanted to share. And it still falls upon me as a former student or somebody who has somehow benefited from their contribution to make peace emotionally, cognitively, with who they are, and not carry resentment. But in some sense, I feel they're the one who broke the relationship. And I would be deluding myself if I think that the relationship persists in face of their violation. That's where I come from.
Thank you. And I this is a good example of how I felt that, you know, what I might say would strike someone as off or wouldn't tell the full story. Because there are many examples of people that whom we've revered and held up as lineage ancestors in the case of Buddhist teachers or mentors or, you know, people entrusted with our faith and our lives who have betrayed us. And I'm not saying, you know, that we should accept what they did and it's okay, but we have to process it and it's our experience, you know, and so calling on compassion for ourselves and also, you know, for them in some way. Everyone is included. Even the worst people that we can imagine has to be included in our practice of compassion and waking up. That's the hard, hard, hard thing about all of this. Yeah. Thank you so much for your comments.
Joro, I particularly like the reference to the Ehe Koso with reminding us of we are one Buddha and one mind, and thinking of those ancestors along with the earlier ancestors that you spoke about that have shaped America and shaped our culture, and those two are one Buddha and one mind and very much a part of me. So that was a nice connection to a revered chant that we like to do so much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Susan.
And then Thank Catherine. You for a wonderful Dharma talk. I'm really happy to hear your words. And I was heartened especially to hear you speak of that we carry the ancestors within us, and as we heal ourselves and become enlightened ourselves, that translates back to those that might have caused harm or might have been deluded or in ignorance or whatever the case may be, that this isn't just about me, it's about everyone. And if I can make a little bit of a step in the right direction, who knows what kind of healing that can be. And I often think of each person as a hologram that everyone is in each one of us. Everyone, including mm-hmm. the planet and our whole system, is in each one of us. And maybe we don't have any concept of how we impact others and the whole through that. So I'm really delighted to hear the words you shared tonight. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And I think that's why Duncan Williams invoking Indra's net, you know, which is all being, you know, in each knot with this jewel that mirrors every single other, you know, it's totally interconnected and it doesn't exclude anything or anyone.
Yeah.
That is a hard thing for us to grapple with when we're in a lot of pain.
Yes.
But yeah. Thank
and
you.
also looking forward to future generations. That's really important too.
Thank you.
Kathy.
Yeah, hi. I'm wondering, just obviously this is a subject that you are attending to very closely, and you're reaching out in terms of seeking the wisdom of a lot of other contemporary teachers, excellent teachers, and bringing in Dogen, encouraging us to deeply explore these causes and conditions. I'm just curious, in your very own practice, like, what is your kind of burning question right now that you're working with in terms of, you know, where your own life intersects with this challenge of reckoning that we're all involved in? I would love to just hear kind of the direction that your own personal inquiry is going right now.
I'll try to make it brief. I think, I am a daughter of immigrants. My father was born in Italy, and, it's a long time ago now, but it doesn't seem so long ago for me. I knew my grandparents, and I knew one of my great-grandparents. And so I was sitting one day in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and suddenly it occurred to me, why did my grandfather come to Italy? It was so I could sit Zazen, you know? And that sounds kind of grandiose, but that's why what Zenju says about her experience of the ancestors speaking to her echoed with me. Like, what am I doing? You know, this is not really what my forebears maybe expected that their grandchildren would be doing, but they wanted us to have the lives that we could choose, that we couldn't choose where we came from. Mm. You know, we were poor people, and my grandmother was illiterate. Mm-hmm. So that's part of it. And also, the country is in such a paroxysm right now, this huge reckoning, which isn't just about race, it's about everything. And so how do I respond? I'm a priest, I'm a white woman. You know, what can I offer? So this is actually, I have to say, I want to thank you all, because this is the first time I really tried to speak to this moment. I've been afraid to some extent, you know, of making mistakes. So I've been listening a lot, and I've been seeking the wisdom of friends, and I've been reading, like, you know, it's what we're all doing. And I thought this was a point of entry, because I've been, you know, the Ehe Koso Hotsugan Mon is like my touchstone. It always elated me to hear that we are one Buddha and one ancestor, you know. And so how do we do this with Confederates? You know, how do we do this with all of, you know, all of this? How do we do it? And how do we do it with the people in the present who are afflicting us? We feel are afflicting us. You know, what do we do? So I'm trying to find a way to compassion and including everyone in my practice. Everyone. It's really hard, you know, sometimes. You could talk to Bunkai, whom I live with, and he could tell you about my, you know, sputtering with rage when I read the morning news. But deep down, what I'm trying to do is figure out how to hold all this, and what can I do? Yeah. What's the appropriate response?
I'm moved to hear that this is, maybe one of your first times of really trying to put it out there, and I commend you for not falling for being willing to be afraid and nervous about, you know, how to do it and doing it anyhow. I feel especially moved now and honored to have been here to listen and learn and be inspired by you.
Thank you very much. It's very, very kind, very generous.
Liz.
I also just really want to thank you for the talk. It was really moving and wonderful to hear this topic that we really are all wrestling with. And I felt like what you offered was very deep and creative and gave a lot of resources to really extend out in many, many relationships and directions. So thank you very much. And I was going to ask if you could repeat the name of the woman whose article was in the New York Times, Carolyn?
Yeah, I want to make sure I get her middle name right. Williams is her last name. She's actually she's got quite a family history, as it turns out. Let me just find the whole thing. Sorry. It's in here somewhere. Uh, Yeah, I think that the title of the op-ed is My Body is a Confederate Monument.
Thank you.
Yeah. Just went straight through me. You know, she said things even more explicitly than the passages that I read. It turns out that her great-great-grandfather, is that right, was Edmund Pettus, whom the bridge is named after. One of her ancestors was fathered by him, you know, a grand dragon of the Ku Klux Klan. Mm. So, you know, she is, by saying, I am a great-great-granddaughter and I'm making this, it's I who am asking, you know, to own this history in her body, her skin. She said, my skin is the color of rape.
Mm. Mm.
Right?
Yeah.
Thank you. Hi.
Do you want to say something, Peter?
I did. Parallel to this and your discussion about ancestry, you know, I've struggled ever since I was a young boy with being first a male, and I'll elaborate a little later, and also from German ancestry, both mother and father. And as a young boy, as it began to unfold at the end of World War II, the atrocities that happened there, I always questioned, what is there in me, in my genes, in my ancestry, that's carried forward, that could have done that kind of atrocity to people? And it's ever since I've been a young boy, I've asked that question. And then my mother was head of the Hiroshima Peace Foundation, and a lot of young Japanese girls that were scarred by the bomb stayed in my house. And once again, I asked, what is there in the male in me that would allow something like that to happen? And it's an ongoing quest, an ongoing question, but I just wanted to share that because it's very similar to what other people are sharing. Thank you.
Thank you so much. You know, this violence isn't all of us. We are all capable of terrible things. No, it's not limited to any group or individual. I'll tell you a little story. My father was a veteran of World War II, and he fought in the Pacific. And he was in the occupation of Japan after the atomic bombings. And he firmly believed that he would never have made it home if the Americans had not dropped the bombs. And that was something that was handed to me as, you know, his daughter. And so I became a Zen priest, and I was practicing at the city center of San Francisco Zen Center about 15 years ago. And this delegation of Japanese priests arrived by boat with lanterns that had been lit from the fires of Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Oh.
And they were going to march all the way to the Trinity site in New Mexico, and it had been 60 years, and they were going to extinguish the flame. This is a significant cycle in Japanese thought. Put them out forever. And when they stepped off the boat and they were met by people who were living in the United States who were themselves either or had descended from survivors, I burst into tears. Mm-hmm. And I said to my father was alive at that point, but he wasn't there, but I said, I'm sorry, Dad, but, you know, I have to, you were wrong. You know, it was wrong to do this. This was a terrible thing done. And yet I always loved him and continued to revere him. And, you know, it's just what he went through and his point of view.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I mean, he was no part of that bombing. He was actually in the Signal Corps, so I don't think he saw a lot of action. You know, he was behind the lines a lot. But, and he hadn't held no animosity towards Japanese people as individuals at all. In fact, I have a picture of him at the Kamakura Great Buddha after the war, which I feel is like there's some karma working in that too, you know. Anyway, thank you for your comment. And I think we need to forgive ourselves. We need to forgive everyone.
Thank you.
Well, Choro, thank you very much for zooming in tonight. And
thank you.
It's a real gift that you gave us tonight.
Well, thank you for the gift of the invitation and for your comments and for your attention. And someday when we can travel again, we'll come and visit. Be nice to be with you.
We'd love to have you. We'd love to have you. Thank you. Thank you.
Right. Good night, everyone. Thank you.
Kings are numberless. I vow to save them. Illusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.